This week's episode of the New in Chess podcast features a narration from The Essential Sasonko, a collection of chess portraits based on personal stories authored by chess grandmaster Gena Sasonko. This episode is the second in a two-part story about late Soviet grandmaster Semyon Abramovich Furman.
Semyon Furman, you ask the questions. Continued. In the summer of 1971, in the architect's rest home in Zelenogorsk, outside Leningrad, I was helping Korzhnoi to prepare for his match with Geller. Living in an adjacent cottage were Furman and Karpov. Occasionally, when it was coming up to pre-dinner time, we would visit them. At the approach to the house, Korzhnoi and I deliberately spoke loudly, announcing our approach, so that we would not inadvertently encroach upon their analysis. If the windows were closed, we would throw a handful of sand at them, as lovers do in old French novels. Relating to this time are four training games played between Korzhnoi and Karpov, in which Karpov had the white pieces each time. Two games were drawn, and both players won one game. This training match was a kind of prologue to the dress rehearsal, the final candidates match in Moscow in 1974, and to the fierce battles for the World Championship in the Philippines and in Murano. During these training sessions and matches, card games flourished. In the late 60s, bridge came into fashion, which became one of Furman's passions. As was the case with much then in the Soviet Union, bridge was not officially banned, but it was not recommended. Bridge immediately captivated him completely. Although this did not mean that other card games were forgotten, it was simply that bridge became Sioma's main card passion. In Karpov's opinion, he was never a strong bridge player, although here too he adhered to the classics and studied theory, systems, and ways of bidding. On one occasion, again in Zelenogorsk, while the adults were sitting at the card table, Furman's little son Sasha and Irina Levitna decided to try out an inflatable dinghy. The wind got up and began carrying it away from the bank. When the situation became alarming, everyone grew anxious. "They are already a long way off. We must do something. Until this rubber is completed," said Furman, "no one is going anywhere." Sometimes cards were replaced by dominoes. Needless to say that in this game too, Sioma gave himself up selflessly. The game rarely proceeded in silence, the banging of the dominoes on the table being accompanied by appropriate remarks, often turning into a dispute when the games had finished. Sioma could also put in a witticism, sometimes even a strong one, and he knew many anecdotes and expressions. A particular piquancy was imparted by the contrast with his professor-like appearance. At one of the Spartakiads, the Leningrad team was not performing very well, losing numerous points in matches with weaker opponents. In order to retain chances of any medals, a draw had to be gained in a hopeless adjourned position, and some equal positions had to be won. The last hope was Furman, to whom all the positions were submitted, hoping for a miracle. Sioma sat there snorting for a long time, as usual raising and lowering his eyebrows in perplexity, until finally he spoke. "Well, what can I say? You've messed things up so much there's nothing to be done now." The actual words he used were quite a bit stronger. Everyone burst out laughing. The lost position was resigned without playing on, and draws were agreed in the equal positions. Living out of town also opened excellent prospects for another passioner of Semyon Abramovich, listening to foreign radio stations. Sioma belonged to that not altogether uncommon category of people who knew by heart the operating times of radio stations broadcasting to the Soviet Union. But whereas playing bridge was more of a prank to which they turned a blind eye, the authorities had a less tolerant attitude as regards listening to foreign radio stations. Here, they took defensive measures, making reception difficult or altogether impossible by jamming. The effects of these countermeasures were felt especially strongly in urban areas, so it would be a pity when out of town not to make use of the opportunity. especially since the transistor radio imported by Sioma from abroad had shortwave, in contrast to most Soviet radios, which significantly improved the reception quality. Understandably, this occupation was not encouraged at all, and in the strictest periods of the Soviet Union's history, it was even punished. So it was always done within your own circle. Sioma would not only skillfully skip between the stations, avoiding the most noisy, but he even knew the names of the announcers, directors and authors of the programmes. Freedom, Voice of America, BBC and Voice of Israel. Sioma listened to the radio only in Russian, and knowledge of foreign languages was not his strong point. The benefit he gained from the study of foreign languages at school, as for the overwhelming majority of his compatriots, was close to nil, and then all his free time was taken up with chess. Besides, it's not easy to memorise words at an age when what you want to do is get to the essence of the things expressed by them. After the tournament in Vikingsay in 1975, together with him and Geller, I gave a simultaneous display in Amersfoort. Hearing the greeting of the organisers, which, as a mark of respect to the foreign guests, was given in English, Sioma gently sighed. Mikhail Moseyevich was right. I looked questioningly at him. Sioma explained, "A school in Leningrad was regarded as a chess school. Apart from me and my friend Yuri Borisenko, a number of strong players studied there. In the mid-30s, after winning some strong tournament, the young Botvinnik came to give a report on it. That was how things were done then. We immediately went up to him and asked to look at something on the chessboard, but he said to us, 'Study languages, lads. Foreign languages. Without them, it's hopeless.' He was right. Mikhail Moseyevich was always right." Once, however, he tried to obtain information in a foreign language, hoping to hear only one name, Fischer. That was the night of April 1, 1975, near Moscow, where he and Karpov were preparing for the World Championship match. That day, the deadline expired for the submission of official applications to FIDE. The name of Fischer was not heard in the ether. And 2 days later, Erva officially declared Karpov world champion. Sioma's transistor receiver helped him to endure solitude, which he always found difficult. The course, extending from the ancients to Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, advocating solitude but also demanding considerable inner potential, was completely foreign to him. Sioma felt best in friendly company, and dialogues with himself were replaced by the transistor, which was always with him right up to the final hospital March days of 1978. "What for?" Sioma asked in genuine surprise, when I suggested that he should read something that was then forbidden in the Soviet Union. "I have my radio, so I know what's going on." He wrote practically nothing, with the exception of theoretical reviews in chess publications, following unconsciously the Pythagorean commandment, speak little and write even less. But I can picture him bent low over a sheet of paper and screwing up his short-sighted eyes, looking at the text of a game in order to record it with his characteristic handwriting. That is what everyone did in that recent and so distant pre-computer era. Everyone had his notebooks with analyses, findings, or simply important games written out by hand. Kasparov also used to make such notebooks in his youth, which he still had during one of his first international tournaments in Tilburg in 1981. Of course, the time wasted was terrible. Now both games and variations can be extracted from a database using a single finger, and the time saved can be devoted to analysis, again with the help of the computer. But even so, the time spent then on the restoration, collation, and even copying of variations does not seem to me to have been completely wasted. Similarly, medieval monks transferring the sacred writings onto parchment or paper admitted them through their minds and their hearts, retaining the text more firmly in their memories. There is another of Sioma's rituals that comes to mind, his careful studying the last page of the Izvestia newspaper, where, from time to time, the foreign currency rates were published. Having been abroad, he knew how artificial the figures given there were. The ruble was a non-convertible currency. A joke which was prevalent at that time was not far from the truth. $1 is worth a pound of rubles. I think that he simply gained pleasure from the reading of beautiful words, guilder, krona, drachma, or peso. Foreign currency had to be spent economically abroad in order to buy goods that simply did not exist in the Soviet Union. And there were many such things. Korshnoi remembered how Furman, at a tournament somewhere in Scandinavia, each morning bought a roast chicken, which then cost $1, which he would stealthily consume during the course of the day as his sole food. There was nothing shameful or unusual in this. I knew many sportsmen and musicians who, during visits abroad, would feed themselves for weeks on tin food or smoked sausage taken from home to save on their foreign currency. On their return, this currency had to be exchanged for certificates or checks, which could be used in special shops where goods, mainly foreign, could be bought only by them. There, every shop is like one of our certificate shops, only better, a grandmaster returning from a foreign tournament explained to his friends, who had never been to the West. I think that for Sioma, as for many Soviet citizens, the entire West looked like one large certificate shop. He grew up with concepts such as Stakhanovites, workers helping their factories to exceed the norms, Subotniks, days of voluntary unpaid labour, political informers, personal files, restrictions on travel abroad, and many others which were completely unknown in the West, and which died together with the state that created them. Sioma, as a result of his frequent trips abroad and his regular listening to foreign radio, was familiar, if perhaps only outwardly and superficially, with the life of the other world. These two worlds easily got on in him without provoking any contradiction. He accepted them as given, as something that goes without saying, drawing a clear watershed between the one and the other. Moreover, as many others, he combined the scepticism and irony with regard to the country where he lived with a fair dose of patriotism.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
In December 1971, I was helping Korshnoi during a big international tournament in Moscow. Furman was also there as Karpov's trainer, and Sioma and I lived together for the whole 2 weeks in the same hotel room. At the time, this was considered normal. Spassky told me, even during one of his matches for the World Championship with Petrosian, he shared a room with Bondarevsky, who was then his trainer. That was how it was in those times. Only later I began to understand what is meant by privacy. Moscow, then, was not the best place for evening and nighttime entertainment. Therefore, towards 10 o'clock, our room, which was regarded as a kind of neutral territory, would see the bridge players assembling. The late Leonid Stein, Hort and Palmer, occasionally Ullmann and Korshnoi, and sometimes Karpov would look in. Sioma, of course, was always present. I would usually lie on my bed reading, from time to time raising my head at the noise, the consequence of fierce debates flaring up over the bridge table regarding alternative lines of play or information incorrectly communicated during the bidding. They usually dispersed at around 3, sometimes even later. Sioma would open the window as the room would be incredibly smoky and, returning to the real world and noticing me, he would always ask one and the same question. "Well, Gennady, what's new in the world?" He always called me this, by my full name. Slightly glancing down, I would reply, "How can I know what's new in the world, Semyon Abramovich, if the machine hasn't been working?" "We'll find out now," he would reply, and Bending low over the illuminated dial, he would begin tuning the transistor to the required wavelength. Picking his way through the noise of the jamming, he would repeat, "I wonder what Anatoly Maximovich has in store for us tonight." Syoma had in mind Anatoly Maximovich Goldberg, the BBC commentator, who was exceptionally popular among underground radio listeners. If he managed to obtain more or less tolerable reception, he would suggest, "Well, shall we have a last one?" We would each smoke a cigarette, which often turned out to be the last but one, and I, seating myself nearer to the receiver, would say, "In Russia, we all take delight in hearing the BBC at night." "Shush, shush, let me listen," Syoma would bring me to order. He took this nightly ritual very seriously. I could not imagine then that 12 years later I would be giving my first report about the Kasparov-Karpov match from the studios of the BBC in London to the Soviet Union. Although Syoma was then no longer alive, I could picture him among my imaginary listeners when I resorted to my favourite formula, as chess fans in the Soviet Union no doubt know, after which I would give some fact that they did not and could not know.
"Semyon Abramovich, you were again up all night playing cards," Karpov once reprimanded him. "I heard Hort coming back at 3 o'clock. His room is next to mine." "Firstly, it was 2:15 when we dispersed," Syoma feebly defended himself. "And secondly, how should I know why Hort arrived back in his room at 3 in the morning? "And the fact that you smoke shamelessly and don't stick to your diet, what about that?" continued Karpov.
"How can you say, Tolya, that I don't stick to my diet when I bought some grapefruit yesterday? There are a couple on the windowsill here."
"And what about the fact that in the adjourned position with Ullman?"
Tolya did not let up. At this point, I left the room, asking myself which of them, in fact, was more than 30 years older than the other. Furman and I played 2 games after I had moved to the West. In both of them, I had white. Here, I used to feel I was Furman. I still see his glance flashing from under his spectacles, where in the first of them, in Vikensee in 1975, I employed an innovation on the 8th move, effectively refuting the entire variation. However, I did not manage to win the game, nor the one in Bad Lauterburg 2 years later, where he voluntarily went in for a position with an isolated pawn in the opening. It seemed to me that Black could not play in this way, but after spending much time and finding nothing, I offered a draw. Parrying during analysis my attempts to demonstrate an advantage for White, Syoma came out with his usual,
"Hold on, old chap, I've analysed this variation," adding, "Don't get upset, have a good look. Here, Black has active play."
There in Bad Lauterburg, in the mornings we would stroll about in the park, talking about this and that. Sometimes we were joined by Libazon. Each time he saw Furman, he would let out a joyful cry, "If Syoma is here, victory is near." They had known each other for a long time, having met at all union and army competitions back in the Soviet Union.
"Well, Syoma," Libazon would usually begin, "how is our native Soviet power?"
Here he was not usually squeamish about using strong language. More often he would go off into reminiscences about the past, in which there was always something absurd, especially when this past relates to the Soviet Union. Libazon had left for Israel only 4 years earlier, and for him the past had not yet become final enough in order to acquire its unconditional charm. Syoma would raise and lower his eyebrows, interject retorts from time to time, or begin to breathe heavily, which would herald laughter, growing into infectious peals, often with his head thrust forward. The few passers-by in the park of this provincial little German town would turn round and look at us disapprovingly. Outwardly, Syoma looked old. His baldness had extended, further emphasising the considerable dimensions of his forehead. His remaining hair was nearly all grey, but neither was noticeable in his spirit. According to the Greek philosopher Solon, the best period in a man's life is from 35 to 56. If Solon had been acquainted with professional chess players of the very end of the second millennium, he would probably have thought differently. But during that tournament, Furman was in fact 56, and he still played with great energy, taking third place ahead of many well-known grandmasters. The tournament was won by Karpov, who finished 2 points ahead of Timon. It was obvious that Furman's collaboration with Karpov had proved very fruitful for both of them. Furman himself once said, "When he is around, I mobilise myself to the utmost and play better. I won't have the same authority if I perform badly. How then will I be able to give him advice?" On one occasion, I was present during their joint analysis of an adjourned position. They had already been together for 10 years and had a very close understanding. They had become accustomed to each other in the manner of a married couple who had been living together for all that time. In Bad Lauterberg, I called in to see Furman, who had caught a slight cold, and found Karpov with him.
"Our Semyon Abramovich," he said, looking into space, "first drinks hot tea with honey, then he goes out onto the street in the wind, and now he is complaining that he has caught a cold. It would be strange if he had not caught a cold." "Firstly, I did not go out straight away, but waited a while. And secondly, Tolya, I put on my woolen scarf," said Semyon Abramovich, trying to justify himself. "He thinks that if he puts on his woolen scarf," continued Tolya, and I once again asked myself who, in fact, was the older of the two. This was his last tournament, and the last time I saw him. Alla Furman said, "Perhaps, had it not been for that nervousness and the sleepless nights, had he looked after himself more, had not smoked so recklessly, he might have avoided all that. He lived as if death did not concern him, not allowing any conversations about illnesses, not about this, not about that. He did everything that he liked." Unconsciously, Sioma lived following the rule of Nietzsche, which supposed that the secret of extracting the most pleasure from existence is simple. You have to live with the greatest risk for life itself, to live on the edge of the abyss. Karpov recalls, "3 weeks before his death, I was with him in the Meshnikov hospital. He was joking, laughing, and making plans for the match with Korshnoi. Which openings to play, how, and what? He did not know that his condition was hopeless, and to be honest, I also did not know." Semyon Abramovich Furman died on March 16, 1978. Despite the fact that his life was not a long one, I think that it was a success. If, in the manner of the ancient Thracians, he had placed after each happy day lived a white stone, and after each unhappy day a black one, the count, after his death, would have given a clear result. The white colour, which he so loved in chess, would easily have predominated. The match for the World Championship between Karpov and Korshnoi began a few months after his death. Having been in Belgrade for the candidates' final match, and having seen Korshnoi's powerful play from close to, Furman undoubtedly realised that the World Championship match would not be an easy one. How would he have felt when in Baguio, apart from the real and enormous strength of his opponent, the entire power of the state machine was hurled against Korshnoi, a part of which, one way or another, he would have had to be. A lover of information, he would certainly have known that in January 1978, a slim 14-year-old boy from Baku won the first game in his life against a grandmaster and his first adult tournament in Minsk. But he could not have known that 7 years later, this boy would take from his pupil the champion's title and would personally rule the chess world for the next 15 years. How would he have reacted to present-day chess, which is so different from the game he himself played? Chess, in which has appeared so much that is new, and which has been accelerated, punishing uncertainty, but also excessive thinking in search of the best move. What advice would he have given Karpov now? Try not to get into time trouble? Spend less time on stamps, about which Sioma grumbled to his pupil even in the best times? Increase the number of training sessions, trust more in the computer, or simply repeat the words said in his time by the Polish master Reszpiłka. "Why do I play worse? Because I am getting old. Come on, youngsters, join the fray."
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the New in Chess podcast. A hard copy version of the Essential Sasonko is available for purchase on the New in Chess website, newinchess.com. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support, and we hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.